the other would still have hers left. Now, the portmanteau, let us make haste, the portmanteau. And the two young girls began to heap into a trunk all the things they thought they should require. There, now, said Eugenie, while I change my costume, do you lock the portmanteau. Louise pressed with all the strength of her little hands on the top of the portmanteau. But I cannot, said she. I am not strong enough. Do you shut it?
Ah, you are right, said Eugenie, laughing. I forgot I was Hercules, and you only the pale Amphale.
And the young girl, kneeling on the top, pressed the two parts of the portmanteau together, and Mademoiselle d'Army passed the bolt of the padlock through. When this was done, Eugenie opened a drawer, of which she kept the key, and took from it a wadded violet silk travelling cloak. Here, said she, you will see I have thought of everything. With this cloak you will not be cold.
But you?
Oh, I am never cold, you know. Besides, with those men's clothes,
will you dress here?
Certainly. Shall you have time? Do not be uneasy, you little coward. All our servants are busy discussing the grand affair. Besides, what is there astonishing when you think of the grief I ought to be in that I shut myself up? Tell me.
No, truly, you comfort me.
Come and help me. From the same drawer she took a complete man's costume, from the boots to the coat, and a provision of linen where there was nothing superfluous but every requisite. Then, with a promptitude which indicated this was not the first time she had amused herself by adopting the garb of the opposite sex, Eugenie drew on the boots and pantaloons, tied her cravat, buttoned her waistcoat up to the throat, and put on a coat which admirably fitted her beautiful figure.
"Oh, that is very good. Indeed, it is very good," said Louise, looking at her with admiration. "But that beautiful black hair, those magnificent braids, which made all the ladies sigh with envy, will they go under a man's hat like the one I see down there?"
"You shall see," said Eugenie, and seizing with her left hand the thick mass which her long fingers could scarcely grasp, she seized with her right hand a pair of long scissors, and soon the steel met through the rich and splendid hair, which fell entire at the feet of the young girl, who leaned back to keep it from her coat. Then she passed to the front hair, which she also cut off, without expressing the least regret. On the contrary, her eyes sparkled with greater pleasure than usual under her eyebrows, black as ebony.
"Oh, the magnificent hair," said Louise with regret.
"And am I not 100 times better thus?" cried Eugenie, smoothing the scattered curls of her hair, which had now quite a masculine appearance. "And do you not think me handsomer so?"
"Oh, you are beautiful."
"Always beautiful," cried Louise.
"Now, where are you going?"
"To Brussels, if you like. It is the nearest frontier. We can go to Brussels, Liège, Aix-la-Chapelle, then up the Rhine to Strasbourg. We will cross Switzerland and go down into Italy by Mount St. Gotthard. Will that do?"
"Yes."
"What are you looking at?"
"I am looking at you. Indeed, you are adorable like that. One would say you were carrying me off."
"And they would be right, pardieu.
Oh, I think you swore, Eugenie."
And the two young girls, whom everyone might have thought plunged in grief, the one on her own account, the other from interest in her friend, burst out laughing as they cleared away every visible trace of the disorder which had naturally accompanied the preparations for their escape. Then, having blown out their lights, with an inquiring eye, listening ear, and extended neck, the two fugitives opened the door of a dressing-room which led by a side staircase down to the yard, Eugenie going first and holding with one arm the portmanteau, which, by the opposite handle, Mademoiselle d'Army scarcely raised with both hands. The yard was empty. The clock was striking 12. The porter was not yet gone to bed. Eugenie approached softly and saw the old man sleeping soundly in an armchair in his lodge. She returned to Louise, took up the portmanteau, which she had placed for a moment on the ground, and they reached the archway under the shadow of the wall. Eugénie concealed Louise in an angle of the gateway, so that if the porter chanced to awake, he might see but one person. Then, placing herself in the full light of the lamp which lit the yard, "Gate!" cried she, with her finest contralto voice, and rapping at the window. The porter got up as Eugénie expected, and even advanced some steps to recognize the person who was going out, but seeing a young man striking his boot impatiently with his riding whip, he opened it immediately. Louise slid through the half-open gate like a snake, and bounded lightly forward. Eugénie, apparently calm, although in all probability her heart beat somewhat faster than usual, went out in her turn. A porter was passing. They gave him the portmanteau. Then the two young girls, having told him to take it to No. 36 Rue de la Victoire, walked behind this man, whose presence comforted Louise. As for Eugénie, she was strong as a Judith or a Delilah. They arrived at the appointed spot. Eugénie ordered the porter to put down the portmanteau, gave him some pieces of money, and, having rapped at the shutter, sent him away. The shutter where Eugénie had rapped was that of a little laundress who had been previously apprised and was not yet gone to bed. She opened the door. "Mademoiselle," said Eugénie, "let the porter get the post-chaise from the coach-house and fetch some post-horses from the hotel. Here are 5 francs for his trouble." In a quarter of an hour, the porter returned with a postboy and horses, which were harnessed and put in the post-chaise in a minute, while the porter fastened the portmanteau on with the assistance of a cord and a strap. "Here is the passport," said the postillion. "Which way are we going, young gentleman?"
"To Fontainebleau," replied Eugénie, with an almost masculine voice.
"What do you say?" said Louise. "I am giving the slip," said Eugénie. "This woman to whom we have given 20 louis may betray us for 40. We will soon alter our direction." And the young girl jumped into the britzka, which was admirably arranged for sleeping in, without scarcely touching the step.
"You are always right," said the singing governess, seating herself by the side of her friend.
A quarter of an hour afterwards, the postillion, having been put in the right road, passed, cracking his whip, through the gateway of Barrière Saint-Martin. Monsieur Danglars had lost his daughter. 99. The Hotel of the Bell and Bottle. And now let us leave Mademoiselle Danglars and her friend pursuing their way to Brussels, and return to poor Andrea Cavalcanti, so uncomfortably interrupted in his career of fortune. Notwithstanding his youth, Master Andrea was a very skilful and intelligent boy. We have seen that, on the first rumour which reached the salon, he had gradually approached the door, and, crossing 2 or 3 rooms, at last disappeared. But we have forgotten to mention one circumstance which, nevertheless, ought not to be omitted. It was that in one of the rooms he crossed, the trousseau of the bride-elect was exposed to view, consisting of cases of diamonds, cashmere shawls, Valenciennes lace, English veils, and, in fact, all those tempting things the bare mention of which makes the hearts of young girls bound with joy, and which is called the corbeille. Now, in passing through this room, Andrea proved himself not only to be clever and intelligent, but also provident, for he helped himself to the most valuable of the ornaments before him. Furnished with this plunder, Andrea leaped with a lighter heart from the window, intending to slip through the hands of the gendarmes. Tall and well-proportioned as an ancient gladiator, and muscular as a Spartan, he walked for a quarter of an hour without knowing where to direct his steps, actuated by the sole idea of removing himself from the spot where he knew he must be taken. Having passed through the Rue Mont Blanc, he found himself, with the instinct which thieves have in avoiding barriers, at the end of the Rue Lafayette. There he stopped, breathless and panting. He was quite alone. On one side was the vast wilderness of the Saint-Lazare, on the other, Paris, in all its darkness. "Am I lost?" he cried. "No,
Not if I can use more activity than my enemies. My safety is now a mere question of speed. At this moment he perceived a cab at the top of the Faubourg Poissonnière. A dull driver smoking his pipe appeared to be seeking to regain the extremities of the Faubourg Saint-Denis, where, no doubt, he ordinarily stood. "Ho, friend," said Benedetto. "What do you want, sir?" asked the driver. "Is your horse tired?"
"Tired? Oh, yes, tired enough. He has done nothing the whole of this blessed day. 4 wretched fares and 20 sous over, making in all 7 francs, are all that I have earned, and I ought to take 10 to the owner.
Will you add these 20 francs to the 7 you have?"
"With pleasure, sir. 20 francs are not to be despised. Tell me what I am to do for this."
"A very easy thing, if your horse be not tired.
I tell you, he will go like the wind. Only tell me which way to drive."
"Towards the Louvre."
"Ah, I know it. The land of Ratafia."
"Exactly so. I merely wish to overtake one of my friends, with whom I am going to hunt tomorrow at Chapelle-en-Serval. He should have waited for me here with a cabriolet till 11:30. It is 12, and tired of waiting, he must have gone on. Will you try and overtake him?"
"Nothing I should like better."
"If you do not overtake him before we reach Bourget, you shall have 20 francs. If not before Louvre, 30.
"And if we do overtake him?"
40, said Andrea, after a moment's hesitation, at the end of which he remembered that he might safely promise.
"That will do," said the man. "Get in, and we're off. Prrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr
Saint-Denis, along the Faubourg Saint-Martin, crossed the barrier, and threaded its way through the interminable Villette. They never overtook the chimerical friend, yet Andrea frequently inquired of walking passers, and at the inns which were not yet closed, for a green cabriolet and bay horse. And, as there are a great many cabriolets to be seen on the road to the Pays-Bas, and 9/10 of them are green, the inquiries increased at every step. Everyone had just seen it pass. It was only 500, 200, 100 steps in advance. At length they reached it, but it was not the friend. Once the cab was also passed by a calèche, rapidly whirled along by 2 post-horses. "Ah," said Cavalcanti to himself, "if I only had that britzka, those 2 good post-horses, and above all, the passport that carries them on." And he sighed deeply. The calèche contained Mademoiselle Danglars and Mademoiselle d'Army. "Onwards, onwards," said Andrea. "We must overtake him soon." And the poor horse resumed the desperate gallop it had never slackened since leaving the barrier, and arrived smoking at Louvre. "Certainly," said Andrea, "I shall not overtake my friend, but I shall kill your horse. Therefore I had better stop. Here are 30 francs. I will sleep at the Cheval Rouge, and will secure a place in the first coach. Good night, friend." And Andrea, after placing 6 pieces of 5 francs each in the man's hand, leaped lightly onto the pathway. The coachman joyfully pocketed the sum and turned back on his road to Paris. Andrea pretended to go towards the hotel of the Cheval Rouge, but after leaning an instant against the door and hearing the last sound of the cab which was disappearing to view, he went on his road, and with a firm tread prepared for a walk of 2 leagues. Then he rested. He must be near Chapelle-en-Serval, where he pretended to be going. It was not fatigue that stayed Andrea here. It was that he might form some resolution, adopt some plan. It would be impossible to make use of a diligence, equally so to engage post-horses. To travel either way, a passport was necessary. It would also be impossible to remain in the department of the Oise, one of the most open and strictly guarded in France. He sat down by the side of the moat, buried his face in his hands, and reflected. 10 minutes after, he raised his head. His resolution was made. He threw some dust over the paletot, which he had found time to unhook from the antechamber and button over his ball costume, and going to Chapelle-en-Saval, he knocked loudly at the door of the only inn in the place. The host opened it. "My friend," said Andrea, "I was coming from Mortefontaine to Senlis when my horse, which is a troublesome creature, stumbled and threw me. I must reach Compiègne tonight, or I shall cause deep anxiety to my family. Could you let me hire a horse of you?" An innkeeper has always a horse to let, whether it be good or bad. The host of La Chapelle-en-Saval called the stable-boy and ordered him to saddle Le Blanc. Then he awoke his son, a child of 7 years, whom he ordered to ride before the gentleman and bring back the horse. Andrea gave the innkeeper 20 francs, and in taking them from his pocket dropped a visiting card. This belonged to one of his friends at the Café de Paris, so that the innkeeper, picking it up after Andrea had left, was convinced that he had let his horse to Monsieur le Comte de Morléon, 25 Rue Saint-Dominique, that being the name and address on the card. Le Blanc was not a fast animal, but it went equally and steadily. In 3 hours and a half, Andrea had run over the 9 leagues which lie between Compiègne, and 4 o'clock struck as he reached the place where the diligences stop. There is an excellent hotel at Compiègne, well remembered by those who have ever been there. Andrea, who had often stayed there in his rides about Paris, recollected the Hotel of the Bell and Bottle. He turned round, saw the sign by the light of a reflected lamp, and having dismissed the child, giving him all the small coin he had about him, he began knocking at the door, reflecting, with justice, that having now 3 or 4 hours before him, he had best fortify himself against the fatigues of the morrow by a sound sleep and a good supper. A waiter opened the door. "My friend," said Andrea, "I have been dining at Saint-Jean-en-Bois, and expected to catch the coach which passes by at midnight, but, like a fool, I have lost my way, and have been walking for the last 4 hours in the forest. Show me into one of those pretty little rooms which overlook the court, and bring me a cold fowl and a bottle of Bordeaux." The waiter had no suspicions. Andrea spoke with perfect composure. He had a cigar in his mouth and his hands in the pocket of his paletot. His clothes were elegant, his chin smooth, his boots irreproachable. He looked merely as if he had stayed out very late, that was all. While the waiter was preparing his room, the hostess rose. Andrea assumed his most charming smile and asked if he could have No. 3, which he had occupied on his last stay at Compiègne. Unfortunately, No. 3 was engaged by a young man who was travelling with his sister. Andrea appeared in despair, but consoled himself when the hostess assured him that No. 7, prepared for him, was situated precisely the same as No. 3, and while warming his feet and chatting about the last races at Chantilly, he waited until they announced his room to be ready. Andrea had not spoken without cause of the pretty rooms looking out upon the court of the Bell Hotel, which, with its triple stages of galleries, looking like a theatre, with the jessamine and clematis twining round the light columns, forms one of the prettiest entrances to an inn you can imagine. The fowl was fresh, the wine old, the fire clear and sparkling, and Andrea was surprised to find himself eating with as good an appetite as though nothing had happened. Then he went to bed, and almost immediately fell into that deep sleep which is sure to visit men of 20 years of age, even when they are torn with remorse. Now here we are obliged to own that Andrea ought to have felt remorse, but that he did not. This was the plan which had appeared to him to afford the best chance of his security. Before daybreak he would awake, leave the hotel after rigorously discharging his bill, and reaching the forest he would, under pretense of making studies in painting, test the hospitality of some peasants, procure himself the dress of a woodcutter and a hatchet, casting off the lion's skin to assume that of the woodman. Then, with his hands covered with dirt, his hair darkened by means of a leaden comb, his complexion embrowned with a preparation for which one of his old comrades had given him the recipe, he intended through different forests to reach the nearest frontier, walking by night and sleeping in the day in the forests and quarries, and only entering inhabited districts to buy a loaf from time to time. Once past the frontier, Andrea proposed making money off his diamonds, and by uniting the proceeds to 10 banknotes he always carried about with him in case of accident, he would then find himself possessor of about 50,000 livres, which he philosophically considered as no very deplorable condition after all. Moreover, he reckoned much on its being to the interest of the Danglars to hush up the rumour of their own misadventures. These were the reasons which, added to the fatigue, caused Andrea to sleep so soundly. In order that he might wake early, he did not close the shutters, but contented himself with bolting the door and placing on the table an unclasped and long-pointed knife, whose temper he well knew, and which was never absent from him. About 7 in the morning, Andrea was awakened by a ray of sunlight, which, warm and brilliant, played upon his face. In all well-organized brains, the predominating idea, and there always is one, is sure to be the last thought before sleeping, and the first upon waking in the morning. Andrea had scarcely opened his eyes when his predominating idea presented itself and whispered in his ear that he had slept too long. He jumped out of bed and ran to the window. A gendarme was crossing the court. A gendarme is one of the most striking objects in the world, even to a man void of uneasiness, but for one who has a timid conscience, and with good cause, too, the yellow, blue, and white uniform is really very alarming. "Why is that gendarme there?" asked Andrea of himself. Then, all at once, he replied, with that logic which the reader has doubtless remarked in him, "There is nothing astonishing in seeing a gendarme at an inn. Instead of being astonished, let me dress myself." And the youth dressed himself with a rapidity his valet de chambre had failed to divest him of during the few months of fashionable life he had led in Paris. "Good," said Andrea, while dressing himself. "I'll wait till he leaves, and then I'll slip away." And saying this, Andrea, who had now put on his boots and cravat, stole gently to the window, and a second time lifted up the muslin curtain. Not only was the first gendarme still there, but the young man now perceived a second yellow, blue, and white uniform at the foot of the staircase, the only one by which he could descend, while a third on horseback, holding a musket in his fist, was posted as a sentinel at the great street door which alone afforded the means of egress. This appearance of the third gendarme was particularly decisive, for a crowd of curious loungers was extended before him, effectually blocking the entrance to the hotel. "They seek me," was the first thought of Andrea. "Diable!" A pallor overspread the young man's forehead, and he looked around him with anxiety. His room, like all those on the same floor, had but one outlet to the gallery in the sight of everybody. "I am lost," was his second thought, and indeed, for a man in Andrea's situation, an arrest comprehended the assizes, the trial, and death, death without mercy or delay. For a moment he convulsively pressed his head within his hands, and during that brief period he became nearly mad with terror. But soon a ray of hope glanced through the crowd of thoughts which bewildered his mind, and a faint smile played upon his white lips and pallid cheeks. He looked round and saw the objects of his search upon the chimney-piece. They were a pen, ink, and paper. With forced composure, he dipped the pen in the ink and wrote the following lines upon a sheet of paper. "I have no money to pay my bill, but I am not a dishonest man. I leave behind me as a pledge this pin worth 10 times the amount. I shall be excused for escaping at daybreak, for I was ashamed." He then drew the pin from his cravat and placed it on the paper. This done, instead of leaving the door fastened, he drew back the bolts and even placed the door ajar, as though he had left the room forgetting to close it, and sliding up the chimney like a man accustomed to those sort of gymnastic exercises, having effaced the very marks of his feet upon the floor, he commenced climbing the hollow tunnel which afforded him the only means of escape left. At this precise time, the first gendarme Andrea had noticed walked upstairs, preceded by the commissary of police, and supported by the second gendarme who guarded the staircase, and was himself reinforced by the one stationed at the door. Andrea was indebted for this visit to the following circumstances. At daybreak, the telegraphs were set at work in all directions, and almost immediately the authorities in every district had exerted their utmost endeavours to arrest the murderer of Caderousse. Compiègne, that royal residence and fortified town, is well furnished with authorities, gendarmes, and commissaries of police. They, therefore, commenced operations as soon as the telegraphic dispatch arrived, and the Bell and Bottle being the first hotel in the town, they had naturally directed their first inquiries there. Now, besides the reports of the sentinels guarding the Hôtel de Ville, which is next door to the Bell and Bottle, it had been stated that a number of travellers had arrived there during the night. The sentinel, who was relieved at 6 o'clock in the morning, remembered perfectly that just as he was taking his post a few minutes past four, a young man arrived on horseback with a little boy before him. The young man, having dismissed the boy and horse, knocked at the door of the hotel, which was opened and again closed after his entrance. This late arrival had attracted much suspicion, and the young man being no other than Andrea, the commissary and gendarme, who was a brigadier, directed their steps towards his room. They found the door ajar. "Uh-oh," said the brigadier, who thoroughly understood the trick. "A bad sign to find the door open. I would rather find it triply bolted." And indeed the little note and pin upon the table confirmed, or rather supported, the sad truth. Andrea had fled. We say supported because the brigadier was too experienced to yield to a single proof. He glanced round, looked in the bed, shook the curtains, opened the closets, and finally stopped at the chimney. Andrea had taken the precaution to leave no traces of his feet in the ashes, but still it was an outlet, and in this light was not to be passed over without serious investigation. The brigadier sent for some sticks and straw, and having filled the chimney with them, set a light to it. The fire crackled and the smoke ascended like the dull vapour from a volcano, but still no prisoner fell down as they expected. The fact was that Andrea, at war with society ever since his youth, was quite as deep as a gendarme, even though he were advanced to the rank of brigadier, and, quite prepared for the fire, he had reached the roof and was crouching down against the chimney-pots. At one time he thought he was saved, for he heard the brigadier exclaim in a loud voice to the two gendarmes, "He is not here!" But venturing to peep, he perceived that the latter, instead of retiring as might have been reasonably expected upon this announcement, were watching with increased attention. It was now his turn to look about him. The Hôtel de Ville, a massive building of the 16th century, was on his right. Anyone could descend from the openings in the tower and examine every corner of the roof below, and Andrea expected momentarily to see the head of a gendarme appear at one of these openings. If once discovered, he knew he would be lost, for the roof afforded no chance of escape. He therefore resolved to descend, not through the same chimney by which he arrived, but by a similar one conducting to another room. He looked round for a chimney from which no smoke issued, and having reached it, he disappeared through the orifice without being seen by anyone. At the same minute, one of the little windows of the Hôtel de Ville was thrown open, and the head of a gendarme appeared. For an instant it remained motionless as one of the stone decorations of the building. Then, after a long sigh of disappointment, the head disappeared. The brigadier, calm and dignified as the law he represented, passed through the crowd without answering the thousand questions addressed to him, and re-entered the hotel. "Well?" asked the two gendarmes. "Well, my boys," said the brigadier, "the brigand must really have escaped early this morning. But we will send to the Via Cotteret and Noyon roads and search the forest when we shall catch him, no doubt." The honourable functionary had scarcely expressed himself thus in that intonation which is peculiar to brigadiers of the gendarmerie, when a loud scream, accompanied by the violent ringing of a bell, resounded through the court of the hotel. "Ah, what is that?" cried the brigadier. "Some traveller seems impatient," said the host. "What number was it that rang?" "Number 3. Run, waiter." At this moment the screams and ringing were redoubled. "Aha!" said the brigadier, stopping the servant. "The person who is ringing appears to want something more than a waiter. We will attend upon him with a gendarme. Who occupies number 3?" "The little fellow who arrived last night in a post-chaise with his sister, and who asked for a double-bedded room." The bell here rang for a third time with another shriek of anguish. "Follow me, Monsieur le Commissaire," said the brigadier. "Tread in my steps." "Wait an instant," said the host. "Number 3 has 2 staircases, an interior and an exterior." "Good," said the brigadier. "I will take charge of the interior. Are the carbines loaded?" "Yes, brigadier." "Well, you guard the exterior, and if he attempts to fly, fire upon him. He must be a great criminal from what the telegraph says." The brigadier, followed by the commissary, disappeared by the interior staircase, accompanied by the noise which his assertions respecting Andrea had excited in the crowd. This is what had happened. Andrea had very cleverly managed to descend 2/3 of the chimney, but then his foot slipped, and notwithstanding his endeavours, he came into the room with more speed and noise than he intended. It would have signified little had the room been empty, but unfortunately it was occupied. 2 ladies, sleeping in one bed, were awakened by the noise, and fixing their eyes upon the spot whence the sound proceeded, they saw a man. One of these ladies, the fair one, uttered those terrible shrieks which resounded through the house, while the other, rushing to the bell-rope, rang with all her strength. Andrea, as we can see, was surrounded by misfortune. "For pity's sake," he cried, pale and bewildered, without seeing whom he was addressing, "for pity's sake, do not call assistance. Save me. I will not harm you." "Andrea, the murderer," cried one of the ladies. "Eugenie! Mademoiselle Danglars!" exclaimed Andrea, stupefied. "Help! Help!" cried Mademoiselle D'Army, taking the bell from her companion's hand and ringing it yet more violently. "Save me! I am pursued!" said Andrea, clasping his hands. "For pity, for mercy's sake, do not deliver me up! It is too late. They are coming!" said Eugenie. "Well, conceal me somewhere. You can say you were needlessly alarmed. You can turn their suspicions and save my life!" The 2 ladies, pressing closely to one another and drawing the bedclothes tightly round them, remained silent to this supplicating voice. All their repugnance, all their fear, rose in their imaginations. "Well, be it so," at length said Eugenie. "Return by the same road you came, and we will say nothing about you, unhappy wretch. Here he is! Here he is!" cried a voice in the landing place. "Here he is! I see him!" The brigadier had put his eye to the keyhole and had perceived Andrea standing and entreating. A violent blow from the butt end of the musket burst open the lock, 2 more forced out the bolts, and the broken door fell in. Andrea ran to the other door leading to the gallery, ready to rush out, but he was stopped short, and he stood with his body a little thrown back, pale, and with the useless knife in his clenched hand. "Fly, then!" cried Mademoiselle D'Army, whose pity returned as her fears diminished. "Fly!" "Or kill yourself," said Eugenie, in a tone which a vestal in the circle would have used, while ordering the victorious gladiator to finish his vanquished adversary. Andrea shuddered, and looked on the young girl with an expression which proved how little he understood such ferocious humour. "Kill myself?" he cried, throwing down his knife. "Why should I do so?" "Why, you said," answered Mademoiselle Danglars, "that you would be condemned to die, like the worst criminals." "Bah!" said Cavalcanti, crossing his arms. "One has friends." The brigadier advanced to him, sword in hand. "Come, come," said Andrea, "sheathe your sword, my fine fellow. There is no occasion to make such a fuss, since I yield myself." And he held out his hands to be manacled. The 2 girls looked with horror upon this horrid metamorphosis, the man of the world shaking off his covering and appearing the galley-slave. Andrea turned towards them, and with an impertinent smile asked, Have you any message for your father, Mademoiselle Danglars? For, in all probability, I shall return to Paris.
Eugénie covered her face with her hands.
Oh, oh, said Andrea, you need not be ashamed, even though you did post after me. Was I not nearly your husband?
And with this raillery, Andrea went out, leaving the two girls a prey to their own sufferings of shame and to the commentaries of the crowd. An hour after, they stepped into their caleche, both dressed in female attire. The gate of the hotel had been closed to screen them from sight, but they were forced, when the door was opened, to pass through a throng of curious glances and whispering voices. Eugénie closed her eyes, but though she could not see, she could hear, and the sneers of the crowd reached her in the carriage. The next day, they stopped at the Hôtel de Flandre at Brussels. The same evening, Andrea was secured in the conciergerie. 100. The Law. We have seen how quietly Mademoiselle Danglars and Mademoiselle d'Army accomplished their transformation and flight, the fact being that everyone was too much occupied in his or her own affairs to think of theirs. We will leave the banker contemplating the enormous columns of his debt before the phantom of bankruptcy, and follow the baroness, who, after remaining for a moment as if crushed under the weight of the blow which had struck her, had gone to seek her usual adviser, Lucien Debray. The baroness had looked forward to this marriage as a means of ridding her of a guardianship which, over a girl of Eugénie's character, could not fail to be rather a troublesome undertaking. For in those tacit understandings which maintain the bond of family union, the mother is only really the mistress of her daughter upon the condition of continually representing herself to her as a model of wisdom and type of perfection. Now, Madame Danglars feared the penetration of Eugénie and the advice of Mademoiselle d'Army. She had frequently observed the contemptuous expression with which her daughter looked upon Debray, an expression which seemed to imply that she understood all her mother's amorous and pecuniary relationships with the intimate secretary. Unfortunately, in this world of ours, each person views things through a certain medium which prevents his seeing them in the same light as others. And Madame Danglars, therefore, very much regretted that the marriage of Eugénie had not taken place, not only because the match was good and likely to ensure the happiness of her child, but because it would also set her at liberty. She ran, therefore, to Debray's, who, after having, like the rest of Paris, witnessed the contract scene and the scandal attending it, had retired in haste to his club, where he was chatting with some friends upon the events, which served as a subject of conversation for three-fourths of that city known as the capital of the world. At the precise time when Madame Danglars, dressed in black and concealed in a long veil, was ascending the stairs leading to the apartments of Debray, notwithstanding the assurances of the young man that his master was not at home, Debray was occupied in repelling the insinuations of a friend who tried to persuade him that, after the terrible scene which had just taken place, he ought, as a friend of the family, to marry Mademoiselle Danglars and her 2 millions. Debray did not defend himself very warmly, for the idea had sometimes crossed his mind. Tea, play, and the conversation, which had become interesting during the discussion of such serious affairs, lasted till 1 o'clock in the morning. Meanwhile, Madame Danglars, veiled and fainting, awaited the return of Debray in the little green room, seated between 2 baskets of flowers, which she had that morning sent, and which, it must be confessed, Debray had himself arranged and watered with so much care that his absence was half excused in the eyes of the poor woman. At 11:40, Madame Danglars, tired of waiting, returned home. Women of a certain grade are like grisettes in one respect. They seldom return home after 12 o'clock. The baroness returned to the hotel with as much caution as Eugénie used in leaving it. She ran lightly upstairs, and with an aching heart entered her apartment, contiguous, as we know, to that of Eugénie. She was fearful of exciting any remark, and believed firmly in her daughter's innocence and fidelity to her paternal roof. She listened at Eugénie's door, then, hearing no sound, she tried to enter, but the bolts were drawn. Madame Danglars fancied that, fatigued with the terrible excitement of the evening, she had retired to her bed and slept. She called her lady's maid and questioned her.
"Mademoiselle Eugénie," she said, "retired to her apartment with Mademoiselle Darmy. They then took tea together, after which they desired me to leave, saying they required me no longer."
Since then the lady's maid had been below, and, like everyone else, she thought the young ladies were in their own room. Madame Danglars, therefore, went to bed without a shadow of suspicion, and began to muse over the past events. In proportion as her ideas became clearer, so did occurrences at the scene of the contract increase in magnitude. It no longer appeared mere confusion. It was a tumult. It was no longer something distressing, but disgraceful. And then the Baroness remembered that she had felt no pity for poor Mercedes, who had been afflicted with as severe a blow through her husband and son.
"Eugénie," she said to herself, "is lost, and so are we. The affair, as it will be reported, will cover us with shame, for in society such as ours, satire inflicts a painful and incurable wound. How fortunate that Eugénie is possessed of that strange character which has so often made me tremble."
And her glance was turned towards heaven, where that mysterious providence disposes all things, and, out of a fault, nay, even a vice, sometimes produces a blessing. And then her thoughts, cleaving through space as a bird in the air, rested on Cavalcanti. This Andrea was a wretch, a robber, an assassin, and yet his manners indicated a sort of education, if not a complete one. He had been presented to the world with the appearance of an immense fortune supported by an honourable name. How could she extricate herself from this labyrinth? To whom would she apply to help her out of this painful situation? Debray could but give her advice. She must apply to someone more powerful than he. The Baroness then thought of Monsieur de Villefort. It was Monsieur de Villefort who had caused Cavalcanti to be arrested. It was Monsieur de Villefort who had remorselessly brought misfortune into her family as though they had been strangers. But no. On reflection, the Procureur du Roi was not a merciless man, and it was not the magistrate, slave to his duties, but the friend, the loyal friend, who, roughly but firmly, cut into the very core of the corruption. It was not the executioner, but the surgeon, who wished to withdraw the honour of Danglars from the ignominious association with the lost young man they had presented to the world as their son-in-law. From the moment that Villefort, the friend of Danglars, acted thus, no one could suppose that the banker had been previously acquainted with, or had lent himself to, any of the intrigues of Andrea. The conduct of Villefort, therefore, upon reflection, appeared to the Baroness as if shaped for their mutual advantage. But the inflexibility of the Procureur du Roi should stop there. She would see him the next day, and if she could not make him fail in his duties as a magistrate, she would at least obtain all the indulgence he could allow. She would invoke the past, recall old recollections. Monsieur de Villefort would stifle the affair. And after this reasoning, she slept easily. At 9 o'clock next morning, she rose, and without ringing for her maid or giving the least sign of her existence, she dressed herself in the same simple style as on the previous night. Then, running downstairs, she left the hotel, walked to the Rue de Provence, called a fiacre, and drove to Monsieur de Villefort's house. For the last month, this wretched house had presented the gloomy appearance of a lazaretto infected with the plague. Some of the apartments were closed, within and without, and the neighbours would say to each other in a low voice, "Shall we today see another bier leave the house of Monsieur le Procureur du Roi?" Madame Danglars involuntarily shuddered at the aspect of the desolate house. Descending from the fiacre, she approached the door with trembling knees and rang the bell. Three times did the bell ring with a dull, heavy sound, seeming to participate in the general sadness, before the concierge appeared and peeped through the door, which he opened just wide enough to allow his words to be heard. He saw a lady, a fashionable, elegantly dressed lady, and yet the door remained almost closed.
"Do you intend opening the door?" said the Baroness.
"First, madame, who are you?"
"Who am I? You know me well enough."
"We no longer know anyone, madame."
"You must be mad, my friend," said the Baroness.
"Where do you come from?"
"Oh, this is too much, madame."
"These are my orders. Excuse me. Your name?"
"The Baroness Danglars. You have seen me 20 times.
"Possibly, madame. And now, what do you want?"
"Oh, how extraordinary. I shall complain to Monsieur de Villefort of the impertinence of his servants."
"Madame, this is precaution, not impertinence. No one enters here without an order from Monsieur de Vrigny or without speaking to Monsieur le Procureur du Roi."
"Well, my business is with Monsieur le Procureur du Roi."
"Is it pressing business?"
"You can imagine so, since I have not even brought my carriage out yet. But enough of this. Here is my card. Take it to your master."
"Madame will await my return."
"Yes. Go."
The concierge closed the door, leaving Madame Danglars in the street. She had not long to wait. Directly afterwards, the door was opened wide enough to admit her, and when she had passed through, it was again shut. Without losing sight of her for an instant, the concierge took a whistle from his pocket as soon as they entered the court and sounded it. The valet de chambre appeared on the doorstep. "You will excuse this poor fellow, madame," he said as he preceded the baroness, "but his orders are precise, and Monsieur de Villefort begged me to tell you he could not act otherwise than he had done." The baroness ascended the steps. She felt herself strongly infected with the sadness which, as it were, seemed to enlarge the circle of her own, and still guided by the valet de chambre, who never lost sight of her for an instant, she was introduced to the study of the magistrate. Preoccupied as Madame Danglars had been with the object of her visit, the treatment she had received from these underlings appeared to her so insulting that she began by complaining of it. But Villefort, raising his head, bowed down by grief, looked up at her with so sad a smile that her complaints died upon her lips.
"Forgive my servants," he said, "for a terror I cannot blame them for. From being suspected, they have become suspicious."
Madame Danglars had often heard of the terror to which the magistrate alluded, but without the evidence of her own eyesight, she could never have believed the sentiment had been carried so far.
"You, too, then, are unhappy?" she said.
"Yes, madame," replied the magistrate.
"Then you pity me?"
"Sincerely, madame. And you understand what brings me here?" "You wish to speak to me about the circumstance which has just happened?"
"Yes, sir. A fearful misfortune."
"You mean a mischance?"
"A mischance?" repeated the baroness.
"Alas, madame," said the procureur du roi, with his imperturbable calmness of manner, "I consider those alone misfortunes which are irreparable."
"And do you suppose this will be forgotten?"
"Everything will be forgotten, madame," said Villefort. "Your daughter will be married tomorrow, if not today, in a week, if not tomorrow, and I do not think you can regret the intended husband of your daughter."
Madame Danglars gazed on Villefort, stupefied to find him so almost insultingly calm.
"Am I come to a friend?" she asked, in a tone full of mournful dignity.
"You know that you are, madame," said Villefort, whose pale cheeks became slightly flushed as he gave her the assurance.
And truly this assurance carried him back to different events, to those now occupying the baroness and him.
"Well, then, be more affectionate, my dear Villefort,"
said the Baroness. "Speak to me not as a magistrate, but as a friend. And when I am in bitter anguish of spirit, do not tell me I ought to be gay."
Vifor bowed. "When I hear misfortunes named, madame," he said, "I have within the last few months contracted the bad habit of thinking of my own, and then I cannot help drawing up an egotistical parallel in my mind. This is the reason that by the side of my misfortunes, yours appear to me mere mischances. This is why my dreadful position makes yours appear enviable. But this annoys you. Let us change the subject. You were saying, madame..."
"I came to ask you, my friend," said the Baroness, "what will be done with this impostor?"
"Impostor?" repeated Vifor. "Certainly, madame, you appear to extenuate some cases and exaggerate others."
"Impostor, indeed!
Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti, or rather Monsieur Benedetto, is nothing more nor less than an assassin.
Sir, I do not deny the justice of your correction, but the more severely you arm yourself against that unfortunate, the more deeply will you strike our family. Come, forget him for a moment, and instead of pursuing him, let him fly."
"You are too late, madame. The orders are issued."
"Well, should he be arrested, do you think they will arrest him?"
"I hope so."
"If they should arrest him, I know that sometimes prisons afford means of escape. Will you leave him in prison?"
The procureur du roi shook his head.
"At least keep him there till my daughter be married."
"Impossible, madame. Justice has its formalities."
"What? Even for me?" said the Baroness, half jesting, half in earnest.
"For all." "Even for myself, among the rest," replied Vifor.
"Ah!"
exclaimed the Baroness, without expressing the ideas which the exclamation betrayed. Vifor looked at her with that piercing glance which read the secrets of the heart.
"Yes, I know what you mean," he said. "You allude to those terrible rumours spread abroad in the world that all those deaths which have kept me in mourning for the last 3 months, and from which Valentine has only escaped by a miracle, have not happened by natural means."
"I was not thinking of that," replied Madame Danglars quickly.
"Yes, you were thinking of it, and with justice. You could not help thinking of it and saying to yourself, 'You, who pursue crime so vindictively, answer now, why are there unpunished crimes in your dwelling?'"
The Baroness became pale.
"You were saying this, were you not?"
"Well, I own it.
I will answer you."
Vifor drew his armchair near to Madame Danglars. Then, resting both hands upon his desk, he said in a voice more hollow than usual,
"There are crimes which remain unpunished because the criminals are unknown, and we might strike the innocent instead of the guilty. But when the culprits are discovered..."
Vifor here extended his hand towards a large crucifix placed opposite to his desk.
"When they are discovered, I swear to you, by all I hold most sacred, that whoever they may be, they shall die. Now, after the oath I have just taken, and which I will keep, madame, dare you ask for mercy for that wretch?
But, sir, are you sure he is as guilty as they say?
Listen. This is his description. Benedetto, condemned at the age of 16 for 5 years to the galleys for forgery. He promised well, as you see. First a runaway, then an assassin. And who is this wretch?
Who can tell?
a vagabond, a Corsican. Has no one owned him? No one. His parents are unknown. But who was the man who brought him from Lucca? Another rascal like himself, perhaps his accomplice.
The Baroness clasped her hands.
Vifor, she exclaimed in her softest and most captivating manner. For heaven's sake, madame, said Vifor, with a firmness of expression not altogether free from harshness. For heaven's sake, do not ask pardon of me for a guilty wretch. What am I? The law. Has the law any eyes to witness your grief? Has the law ears to be melted by your sweet voice? Has the law a memory for all those soft recollections you endeavour to recall? No, madame. The law has commanded, and when it commands, it strikes. You will tell me that I am a living being and not a code, a man and not a volume. Look at me, madame. Look around me. Have mankind treated me as a brother? Have they loved me? Have they spared me? Has anyone shown the mercy towards me that you now ask at my hands? No, madame. They struck me, always struck me. Woman, siren that you are, do you persist in fixing on me that fascinating eye which reminds me that I ought to blush? Well, be it so. Let me blush for the faults you know, and perhaps for even more than those. But having sinned myself, it may be more deeply than others, I never rest till I have torn the disguises from my fellow creatures and found out their weaknesses. I have always found them, and more, I repeat with joy, with triumph, I have always found some proof of human perversity or error. Every criminal I condemn seems to me a living proof that I am not a hideous exception to the rest. Alas, 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 all the world is wicked. Let us therefore strike at wickedness.
Vifor pronounced these last words with a feverish rage, which gave a ferocious eloquence to his words.
But, said Madame Danglars, resolving to make a last effort, this young man, though a murderer, is an orphan, abandoned by everybody.
So much the worse, or rather, so much the better. It has been so ordained that he may have none to weep his fate. But this is trampling on the weak, sir, the weakness of a murderer. His dishonour reflects upon us. Is not death in my house?
Oh, sir, exclaimed the Baroness, you are without pity for others. Well, then, I tell you, they will have no mercy on you.
Be it so, said Vifor, raising his arms to heaven.
At least delay the trial till the next assizes. We shall then have 6 months before us.
No, madame, said Vifor. Instructions have been given. There are yet 5 days left. 5 days are more than I require. Do you not think that I also long for forgetfulness? While working night and day, I sometimes lose all recollection of the past, and then I experience the same sort of happiness I can imagine the dead to feel. Still, it is better than suffering.
But, sir, he has fled. Let him escape. Inaction is a pardonable offence.
I tell you, it is too late. Early this morning the telegraph was employed, and at this very minute,
sir, said the valet de chambre, entering the room, a dragoon has brought this despatch from the Minister of the Interior. Vifor seized the letter and hastily unsealed it. Madame Danglars trembled with fear. Vifor started with joy.
Arrested, he exclaimed. He was taken at Compiègne, and all is over.
Madame Danglars rose from her seat, pale and cold.
Adieu, sir, she said. Adieu, madame, replied the procureur du roi, as in an almost joyful manner he conducted her to the door. Then, turning to his desk, he said, striking the letter with his right hand, Come, I had a forgery, 3 robberies, and 2 incendiaries. I only wanted a murder, and here it is.